You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 365, or 44, Q&A. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Mike Heiser. Hey, Mike, what's going on?
How many Q&As do you say we've done?
44.
What was that number?
44.
Oh, man. That's crazy. Yeah. I you know, every time we do one of these, I think, like, really? That's hard to believe we've done that many Q&A. I mean, how many? What, we hit like 5 questions each time? That's like 200 questions.
Oh, yeah. We easily. 5 or 6 questions, even more, especially the earlier ones were a lot longer. But I've had to shorten these because that's just too much work. You know, to be honest, Mike, we could probably do 1,000, you know, 1,000 Q&As, as many questions that I've received. Yeah. And again, I apologize to everybody out there who sends me a question. I can't respond to everybody. So just know that I do get your emails. They are in the queue. When and if we ever get to them, we can't guarantee it, but you know, we'll keep chugging away. And Mike, we're going to die before we get through all these questions. So just know that our death will now come that, first.
Yeah. Now that everyone's spirits have been crushed, you know, we can move on.
We'll try. But hey, Mike, this is our 365th episode. So we now officially have one episode for an entire
year.
Yeah.
There
That's
you go.
A positive spin.
See, we should have done something on Enoch, you know, because of the 365. But, well, you know, Q&A is good.
Yeah, well, we can throw a question in there about it. I could pretend like somebody asked about it and you can answer it. All right. Well, congratulations again. You know, 365 is a big number. So,
yeah, you know, it is a big number.
Some of these people, I get emails from some of these people and they listen at work or something 8 hours at a time. And it's just, man, my ears would bleed. Mike, no offense, listening to you that long.
Well, I think my ears would bleed too. Yeah.
I mean, just your brain would blow up from all the content. You know, that's impossible to. You know, I don't know if I could.
It's
work.
Amazing how some people will track through the content like that. I mean, they're right nipping right at our heels, man.
Hey, that's awesome. Binge. We've got so many episodes now. I even get emails from people who get sad when they catch up because. They're so used to binging so many episodes. It's like, what do you do with yourself? Now you got to go look for other podcasts, you know, to get your fix.
You guys are slacking off. You're so lazy. Yeah. Oh, I can just hear it.
Well, Mike, we've got some great questions here. So I'm ready if you are. Might as well just jump in.
Sure.
All right. Our first 2 questions are going to be from Jared. And his first question is, do you think that the original audience for Genesis 3:15 would have actually understood that a single savior would come to defeat the snake? I just can't see the sentence uses a singular, and it looks to me like we will always be fighting with the snake, not a prophecy of a savior. People like to quote that passage a lot, but it seems like a pretty bad prophecy, if anything.
Yeah, I think there are things in the passage that would point to a singular, you know, I hate to use the word fulfillment because, you know, the word fulfill is like the word cute, you know, like it doesn't really mean anything because, you know, we tend to think cause and effect, you know, one-to-one correspondence, whereas New Testament writers, you know, they see fulfillment in a whole spectrum of ways, analogies, typologies, symbols, and so on and so forth. But for the sake of this question, I'll use it. You know, I do think that there are things in the passage that would point to a single person, quote, fulfilling this, you know, verse. That is not to say, though, that all the other stuff in the question isn't true as well. So, I mean, if you just look at it, you know, it's Genesis 3:15. We might as well, you know, quote that passage. Let me just open up a Bible here and read it. I don't want to assume that everyone sort of has this in their head. So, Genesis 3:15, and it'll sound familiar, even if you didn't know exactly where it came from. This is part of the judgment of the Nakash, the serpent. I will put enmity between you and the woman and between your offspring and her offspring. He shall bruise your head and you shall bruise his heel. That's the ESV, and we're going to talk about the translation a little bit as well. The you in this passage, you know, they're singular. They refer to the serpent. Okay, so I will put enmity between you, singular, you know, but your offspring. Again, these are singular, second person singular pronouns that refer to the serpent. So sure, you know, in that sense, since the serpent, you know, is actually, you know, what we have here is a supernatural being, and he lives on and so on, like he's not terminated or anything. So it's obvious in that sense that the struggle, the enmity, okay, is ongoing. That's obvious from the text. And since that's the case, the serpent's metaphorical offspring points to, you know, this ongoing time, you know, and also if that's true, then her seed, okay, the woman's seed is also ongoing to have this ongoing conflict. It can't just work one way. It has to work both. So this notion that, you know, we're always going to be fighting, you know, the effect of the fall, that's obvious. I mean, it's transparent from the text, but it's also a little bit narrow because it excludes certain things. The text also indicates that the ongoing number isn't specifically the point. The idea is that first there will be this struggle, and that's on the table for sure. And then also, at some point, a particular human will crush the serpent's head, because we can't exclude the line, "He shall bruise." This is a third person singular pronoun in the Hebrew text. And that has to point to a particular human offspring of the woman. So he, you know, some seed of the woman is going to, again, do some damage or inflict, you know, some harm or whatever on the serpent. So it does funnel down to a particular person. The same individual is also marked as suffering some affliction from the serpent. Again, just the second part of the verse, he shall bruise your head. He, her offspring, some particular offspring is going to bruise your head, you know, Nakash, and you shall bruise his heel, okay? So there's a particularity here that should not be excluded from the verse. And that's why I would say, you know, there are indications in the text that this can point to a very specific fulfillment. Now, most scholars see Paul, for instance, referencing this verse in Romans 16:20. Let me just read that verse, and this is probably less known by comparison. Paul writes to the Romans in the last chapter, "The God of peace will soon crush Satan under your feet. The grace of our Lord Jesus Christ be with you." Okay. So again, most scholars think this is a reference on Paul's part to Genesis 3:15 because of the vocabulary here. Feet, again, a reference to Satan, the crushing, so on and so forth. You know, I would you know, I don't have anything to disagree with there. However, we need to actually take a look at the verse. In Romans 16:20, where it says, "The God of peace will soon crush Satan under your feet," it's your feet and it's plural. So it's actually a reference to the church, to the believers. Okay, it's not a reference to Jesus. Again, in that verse doing the crushing, but so you have this sort of transference. I would say it this way. There's an indirect reference to Jesus here in what Paul's writing, you know, as the Savior, because believers are corporately the body of Christ, okay? And believers would not be in that status without Christ. The fact that Revelation 12 also connects the birth of the Messiah with the demise of Satan the serpent, I mean, that language is in Revelation 12, also indicates that there's some allusion going on in connection with Jesus back to Genesis 3:15. So in the one passage, Romans 16:20, you have the bruising or the crushing idea. Revelation 12, you don't have that. But nevertheless, the connection is made as to how this sort of works. Now, just as a sidebar, ESV, you probably noticed, has both lines in the second half of Genesis 3:15 translated the same way. It says, "He shall bruise your head and you shall bruise his heel." You know, bruise twice there, has the same translation. Now, that translation, just for those who might, this might pop into your head, or if you're really into this verse, you're going to wonder, you're going to ask the question, why didn't Mike say something about this? Well, I'm going to, okay. The translation presumes that the lemma, you actually, you know, had software or used a concordance here, shuf, is truly the same. So if you're going to translate it, both of them as bruise, the translator is probably assuming that we got the same lemma in both places. But you could have a homograph. Remember, this audience should know what homographs are. A word that is spelled exactly the same way as another word, but they have two different meanings. They're two different semantics. It could also be something what, again, this is an academic term, a linguistics term. It could be a biform. And I'll try to explain briefly what that is. But this is actually a debate. Do we have the same lemma in the verse twice, or do we have two different lemmas that actually look the same? That's a debate that scholars have about Genesis. You'll run into it in commentaries. So it may be, it's indeterminate. It may be that the same lemma is intended in both places. And again, ESV reflects that. But it's also possible that we have the two separate lemmas that are homographs. That's equally possible. If they are homographs, you got two different lemmas here. One means to bruise. The other one would be something like to snap at or snatch at. Think of a serpent, trying to bite somebody's heel, okay? So that very well could be what we have here. And so you're going to see certain translations try to distinguish between these two things. And this is part of the thinking, part of what may be going on in the translator's head. As far as the biform option, again, this is a linguistic term where you have two not identical lemmas, but they're very close, and specifically there are only certain consonants in Hebrew that works this way. So you could have one that is spelled with the sh, the aleph, or the sh and the w, the vav and the p, and another one that's sh and then the aleph and the p, depending on what grammatical form the one with the middle aleph is put into, it can work out spelling-wise, vocalization-wise, as shuf, just like the other one. Even though they're not homographs, they're still two different lemmas, but they can look the same in the text, and so hence this question. Another sidebar, the Septuagint translates these lemmas with the same Greek word, same Greek lemma. So the Septuagint translator probably is looking at this and thinking they come from the same source. Casuto in his commentary writes about this. If you have Casuto's Genesis commentary, be the first volume. He talks about what the options are. So you could go look that up. But again, I just wanted people to know that this is why certain translations in English, some of them will be identical, same word two times, just like ESV. Other ones will vary the vocabulary. So this is part of the issue. But as to the original question, yeah, this can certainly funnel into a very particular offspring of the woman. So that is exegetically defensible.
His second question is, a scholar in our church recently said that writing wasn't developed enough for Moses to actually write down the Pentateuch. He said, it's not like Moses was carrying around tablets that he wrote all this down on. That threw me a bit, and I didn't know what to make of it because I thought the Egyptians were using papyrus long before that. Can you comment on this and how it was likely originally recorded?
Yeah, I've made the comment before as well that Moses isn't carrying a tray of cuneiform tablets along with him, during the Exodus, because, a lot of the content in Genesis does hook into Babylonian texts. And I've said before in the podcast, my suspicion is that either Genesis 1 through 11 was either, written during the exile or was heavily edited, again, using the Akkadian Babylonian material to articulate a theological polemic in those 11 chapters. And that, if that's the case, well then, since that's part of the Torah, then, you have the same question arise for different reasons, about the rest of the Torah. My view is, again, just generally, and then I'll get to the specifics of the question, is that I don't accept JEDP, the consensus view among scholars that the Pentateuch, the Torah, was not written at all by Moses. It's a patchwork quilt of sources and so on and so forth. I don't accept that view, but I also don't accept the traditional view that Moses, wrote the Torah, 99% of it or 100% of it. I think it's somewhere in the middle. I'm what used to be called a supplementarian, and there are different reasons for that. Now, that is preparatory to say you should have detected in that answer that I don't have a problem with Moses being able to write stuff in the Torah. There was another reason that this, scholar in this church said this. He's really basing this on the fact that there are no Paleo-Hebrew inscriptions that we know of that are earlier than 1000 BC. I have to know a little bit about Hebrew. The Hebrew that you're used to seeing today is not the original Hebrew script. There's a Paleo-Hebrew script that would have been used, you know, by Moses or anybody else in greater antiquity. The script that you're familiar with now comes out of the Babylonian exile. It's an adoption of you know, Aramaic in that case, the script that they were using there, and that is referred to as the block letter style. That is not, again, what Hebrew letters look like in the biblical period, okay, something before 1000 BC or even a little bit later than that. So if you look at that material that's been recovered from the ancient world, there are no Hebrew inscriptions that, I'm just using round numbers here, that are earlier than 1000 BC. Well, if Moses lived, 1400 BC is when he died, 1525 to, 1405 BC, obviously he's living in the period for which we do not have epigraphic or inscriptional evidence for Old Hebrew. So that's really what's behind this statement. Now, having said that, it's an assumption. That's all we have here on this person's part. It is, of course, an assumption that this means, the fact that we don't have inscriptions older than 1000 BC in Old Hebrew. That's an assumption that fact, that absence in the archaeological record, means that the written form of Hebrew wasn't developed. You can't really draw that conclusion. You could have written Hebrew developed, and maybe we just don't have stuff that, was produced in it. I mean, if you think about the Hebrews, why do we have inscriptions from any culture? It's because they had a settled civilization. There was the occasion, the need to produce documentary evidence like, stela or inscriptions or whatever, economic records. None of this applies to the Hebrews in Moses' day. The reason that would, I wouldn't expect there to be, like original tablet forms or on any medium, of the Torah in Old Hebrew, is because the Hebrews weren't a settled people. There's no reason for them to produce material that we could point at and look at. It's, oh yeah, the Hebrews living back around Moses' time, they were literate. Look at that inscription there. Why would they produce it? They're not settled in a land. I mean, what's the point? They're not producing receipts or economic records like you see with cuneiform tablets. They don't have any of that. They're wandering around in a desert. They're on their way to a land. And once they get in, they got to, basically start the whole thing from scratch, their civilization. So there's not a necessary connection between the absence of inscriptional data and the idea that the language itself wasn't developed in writing. So that's the first problem, again, the historical circumstances. Now, Moses would have been highly literate, if we accept the biblical account of the guy Moses. He would have been highly literate as someone trained in Pharaoh's household. He'd be expected to read and write Egyptian and very likely Akkadian, at least be able to read Akkadian. And that's especially true if the Exodus was a late Exodus. Just think the 1200s BC instead of the early date. If you don't know what I'm talking about here, go listen to the first four or five episodes of the Book of Exodus series. If it's a later date, this is especially true that Moses would be literate in Egyptian and Akkadian writing, because Akkadian was the language of international correspondence during this period. The Tel El Amarna letters, are written in Akkadian. It's a correspondence between Pharaoh and his underling authorities in what we would call now the Holy Land, in Palestine. It's all Akkadian. It's not Egyptian, it's Akkadian. So if the Hebrew language, again, had been put to writing, there is no reason to suppose that Moses wouldn't have known that language, that script as well. I mean, he knows Egyptian, he knows Akkadian. If Hebrew, again, the language of his native, people, if that has been put into writing, there's no reason to suspect that he wouldn't know it. Now, it is a reasonable expectation that that language had a written form, because the proto-Sinaitic inscriptions date to 400 years earlier than the late date of the Exodus. Again, if you don't know what those are, the proto-Sinaitic inscriptions are important because they are the beginning of the Semitic alphabet, okay, where someone at some of the turquoise mines in Sinai, and this predates the early date of the Exodus. So this has nothing to do with the Exodus, okay? But you've got somebody who's taking Egyptian characters and using them to create an alphabet. and the inscriptions that are in that Egyptian-looking alphabet are Semitic. Okay, they conform to the grammar of Semitic languages. Okay, we don't know who those people were. There's no way to identify them. Again, despite claims of the contrary, I mean, there are people out there that say, oh, we know that the biblical Hebrews produced the Proto-Sinaitic inscriptions. Well, actually, you don't, because all of the features that can be known from those inscriptions are also parts of other Semitic languages. There's no way to directly tie it to the Hebrews in the Bible. Okay, there's no way to do that, even though people, it's a nice idea. Wouldn't that be cool? But you got nothing there, okay? So all that to say, I think that this conclusion that this scholar, again, in your church drew, it's based upon a point of fact, this data about we don't have a Hebrew inscriptions past, or earlier than 1000 BC. But it requires making certain assumptions about what that means that I don't think really hold together well. Or let me just be more charitable, that lack certainty. So again, if Moses is who the Bible says he was, he's going to be highly literate. If the language of his people exists in an alphabet, you better believe that there's no reason to conclude he wouldn't know that. Okay? Again, so we don't know one way or the other, but it's a reasonable thing to conclude that, yeah, Moses could have written stuff.
Our next question is from Evan. I have a question about 1 Kings 22:22, 1 Samuel 16:14, and Ezekiel 14:9. Each verse speaks about an evil or lying spirit coming from God. One extremely popular pastor uses these verses to say that God has predestined and is governing all man's sin. Is God causing, tempting, or predestining the sin of false prophecy? Finally, is the divine council member in these verses evil or tempting?
The short answer to these questions is no and no. Okay? I get questions like this about what some people are listening to and what other people are saying that ought to know better, and just part of me just dies inside. this is a seriously flawed notion. So one of those passages, 1 Kings 22:22, that's going to ring bells, with this audience, because that's the Micaiah passage, 1 Kings 22:19-23, where we have, a divine council session. So again, I'm going to read that just in case people aren't aware of this. Prophet Micaiah said, "Therefore, hear the word of the Lord. I saw the Lord sitting on his throne and all the host of heaven standing beside him on his right hand and on his left." Okay, so that's your first clue to one of the problems with this assumption that this quote-unquote popular pastor is teaching. You have the host of heaven, the heavenly host, i.e. angelic beings, if you want to use that terminology, standing beside the Lord as the Lord sits on his throne. So they're intelligent entities, okay? The Lord said, "Who will entice Ahab that he may go up and fall at Ramoth Gilead?" And one said one thing, another said another. Then a spirit came forward and stood before the Lord. Saying, "I will entice him." And the Lord said to him, "By what means?" He said, "I will go out, be a lying spirit in the mouth of all his prophets." And he said, "You are to entice him, and you shall succeed. Go out and do so." So that's verse 22, a lying spirit in the mouth of all his prophets. And that's one of the launching points for the question. So I would just, putting that passage in everyone's head, and then the 1 Samuel 16:14 verse, we might as well read this, and I'll get to the one in Ezekiel in a bit. 1 Samuel 16:14. "Now the spirit of the Lord departed from Saul, and a harmful spirit from the Lord tormented him." Again, this is ESV. So having those two floating around in our heads now, my first question is, why would we assume that there's sin going on? Why? If the lying spirit is from God, by definition, it isn't sin. God doesn't sin. He doesn't like sin. Why would we conclude that God is endorsing or creating or predestinating sin? Okay, it creates a number of conundra, by virtue of the logic problem there. And the example from 1 Kings is particularly wrongheaded, again, for other reasons. I'm going to try to funnel my discussion here. The spirit comes from the group. The group is the heavenly host standing in Yahweh's presence. Why would we expect that evil, rebellious spirits who are in rebellion, they don't report for work? Okay, they're not on God's payroll anymore. Why would we assume that? Again, it doesn't make sense on a number of levels. So we, again, I think the real issue here is this whole notion of lying and deception and so on and so forth. So you go to 1 Samuel 16:14, and I would say drawing the conclusion that we have moral evil here really reflects either a lack of knowledge about the semantic range of this word that gets translated evil. It's the word ra, okay? We either have a lack of knowledge of the semantic range, or we have, let's be blunt, just laziness. You never looked it up, okay? This word does not need to indicate moral evil, okay? Ra can mean other things besides moral evil, i.e. sin. Let me just go through a few examples. Genesis 37:2, okay? I mean, I can just sit here and do a quick search. I mean, this doesn't take a whole lot of effort here. This is Genesis 37:2. These are the generations of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was pasturing the flock with his brothers. He was a boy with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought a bad report of them to their father. Okay, he brought a bra, okay, bad report. Did Joseph sin when he reported to his father? Is there moral evil in the report? I mean, is there something about the report that is evil? The uttering of the report. Now you could say, well, the content's evil because the sons are just, you know, they're not doing their job or whatever. Yeah, we know that. That's the content of the report. But what I'm asking is the report itself, is it morally evil? Does it have something to do with sin? No. Okay, you keep going in Genesis 37:20, that the word shows up again. Come now, this is the brothers plotting against Joseph. Come now, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. Then we will say that a fierce animal, a ra animal, has devoured him. What is the animal sinful? Is the animal guilty of moral evil, doing what animals do? How about verse 33? Again, we keep going in the same chapter. This is when they hand the cloak with blood on it to Jacob. He identified it and said, it is my son's robe. A fierce animal has devoured him. A ra animal. Again, is the animal sinning? You know, I'm hoping you see the point here. This is a little ridiculous, but let's keep going. Genesis 41. Okay, Genesis 41:33. This is Joseph with interpreting Pharaoh's dream. Okay. Now therefore let Pharaoh select a discerning and wise man and set him over the land of Egypt. That's verse 33. And here's verse 34. Let Pharaoh proceed to appoint overseers over the land and take 1/5 of the produce of the land of Egypt during the 7 plentiful years. And let them gather all the food of those good years that are coming and store up grain under the authority of Pharaoh for the food in the cities. That food shall be a reserve for the land against the 7 years of famine that are to occur in the land, so that, you know, the people aren't going to perish. Now, can anybody guess where, you know, ra occurs? I mean, we didn't come across anything that sounded, you know, like moral evil. Okay. But we actually have a reference to what? We have famine and years of plenty. Where does that come from? Well, it comes from the vision of the cows, if you remember. So if we go back up into the verse, okay, this is Genesis 41:3-4 now. So I went to 33 and 34. That's the context. Go back to verses 3 and 4. Here's where you get the word actually. Behold, 7 other cows, ugly and thin, came up out of the Nile after them and stood by the other cows on the bank of the Nile. And the ugly, thin cows ate up the 7 attractive, plump cows. The word ugly is ra. So should we say, behold, 7 other cows who were sinful and thin came up out of the Nile after them. And those sinful, thin cows ate up the other ones. Again, you could go on and on with these kind of examples. I'll do one more, Leviticus 26:6. I will give you peace in the land, and you shall lie down, and none shall make you afraid. And I will remove the harmful beasts from the land. I will remove the ra beasts from the land. I'll remove the sinful beasts from that. Now, again, ra as a term need not have anything to do with sin and moral evil. What it really means, again, broadly the semantic range of this. Yes, it can include moral evil, obviously, but it can also indicate something unfavorable, harmful, dangerous, and of course, in Joseph's interpretation of Pharaoh's dream, ugly. Boy, these cows just don't look good. Okay, they're stricken by famine. They look awful. So Ra can mean those neutral things. Now, if we go back to 1 Samuel 16:14, where the spirit of the Lord departs from Saul, and a harmful spirit from the Lord tormented him. That's actually a good translation. There's something about this spirit, and it could go either way. It could be an entity, because 1 Kings 22, we have entities there. Or it could just be God afflicting Saul internally, psychologically, Saul's own spirit, okay, something like that. It could go either way. Commentators, you can look this up in virtually any commentator, the commentary that's serious, that engages the text, and you'll get this discussion. But the whole idea is that either God is sending a spirit to trouble Saul, to make him uncomfortable, maybe, harm him psychologically, make him a wreck, make him anxious, irritable, or again, it could be that it's a reference to Saul's internal disposition at all. It doesn't have to have anything to do with moral evil. It's just something unfavorable, harmful, something you wouldn't want to have happen to you, that kind of thing. I think, again, that's what's going on in 1 Samuel 16. You get another example in Judges 9. God sent an evil spirit between Abimelech and the rulers of Shechem. In other words, there's something that God does that creates a conflict between these two groups. Again, one party, one side of the equation is getting judged and the other, side is not, so on and so forth. So God is judging who he wants to judge, who deserves judgment. And I think that's what's going on in these sorts of verses. You go to Ezekiel 14:9. Again, let's just read that, since that was brought up. If the prophet is deceived and speaks a word, I, the Lord, have deceived that prophet, and I will stretch out my hand against him and will destroy him in the midst of my people Israel. Now, the word, Ra doesn't appear in that passage, but it's the idea of God deceiving, some prophet, okay, to destroy him, all right? So all of these things, Ezekiel 14, 1 Samuel 16, what they come down to is that God is judging evil. So here's the question. Is God allowed to use deception or trickery or just make somebody irritable so it starts a fight? Is he allowed to use those means to judge evildoers? I'll follow that with another question. Who's going to tell him that he can't? Of course he can. Okay, God gets to judge evil in whatever way God deems fit. And we did a whole episode on God's use of deception to judge evil. That's episode 210 for anyone who wants to go back and listen to it. God doing that, such things are not evil, for evil is defined, again, in a very basic way for the sake of this Q&A, as that which is contrary to God's will. God doesn't ordain the violations of his own will. He doesn't violate his own will. What he does is by definition not a violation of his own will. God can judge evil however he wills without violating his own will. That's what it comes down to. Judging evil as well is consistent with God's moral character. So I think what's tripping up the discussion here is this talk about, deception and God doing something. I got news for you. At the end of the road, at the end of the day, God is going to deny eternal life to the wicked. So God's means of judging the wicked, short of their eternal destiny, God can do what he wants to judge evil. And he does. Again, you go back and listen to episode 210, you'll get other examples of God using these sorts of means.
Chris in Ledyard, Connecticut has our next question. In studying the Lord's Prayer, I've discovered that the Greek word typically translated in English Bibles as daily, as in give us this day our daily bread, is a mystery. It seems that no one really knows what the true meaning of the word is, and over time, different suggestions have been made, including daily bread, the bread for tomorrow, the supersubstantial or supernatural bread, example, Jesus himself. Can Dr. Heiser provide any additional insight into what the best translation of this word might be, based on the literary structure of the Lord's Prayer and its location within the Sermon on the Mount, Does Dr. Heiser lean toward a natural or supernatural interpretation of the bread in the Lord's Prayer?
The second part, I'll just say, I think it's natural. I think it's talking about physical needs in that passage anyway. The other one, I'm in favor of using other parts in the near context, really the same verse and verses, as the difficult word occurs. I mean, there's other vocabulary in there that I think helps us narrow the possibilities as far as interpretation goes. So let's unpack this a little bit, because I think people may not be aware of the difficulty here. So on the one hand, in part, there's not much of a mystery. You look at Matthew 6:10. Okay, let's just get started in Matthew. This prayer, of course, occurs in more than one gospel. But Matthew 16, your kingdom come, your will be done. Or Matthew 6:10, I should say. Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Here's verse 11. Give us this day our, and then ESV has daily bread. So we have here, give us, and then we have the term semeron. It means tomorrow. Okay, so that it's a time-orienting word. And then it's followed by another term, which is the troublesome one. The lemma there is epiousios. That's the one that there's ambiguity. Like, what does that term mean? And we'll get into that. It's pretty rare, okay? But my suggestion is going to be, let's use the word tomorrow to help us narrow the understanding of the word that is less clear. And let's, loop in sort of a bit of logic here. Jesus would probably endorse the idea of praying every day. And so if you're in the habit of using this prayer as a pattern of prayer regularly, and you know that the time word in there is oriented by, tomorrow, that does give you this day-by-day, quote-unquote, daily feel to it. And again, that's how most commentators, the trajectory they follow. So let's just go back to the term. Semeron, this first term, again, means tomorrow. It's the same word that occurs later in Matthew 6, in verse 34, where it clearly means tomorrow. Again, you can look up the term. The Lord's Prayer in Luke, though, Luke 11:3, uses different terminology. It's ta kath, which is from kata hemeron. It literally means that which, or what is according to a day. So you have, again, this not the tomorrow sense. If you're praying the prayer, again, with regularity, the tomorrow language makes sense. But here you have, again, what is according to a day or to the day. So again, you have this daily sense. And that phrase, again, is in turn clarified by other things in the passage. So if we take what we know, again, you've got this tomorrow, and you've got hemeron, which is the normal word for day. You've got this according to the day, or according, that which is according to a day. If you have these words that are easy to grasp and comprehend, my predilection is going to be to use them to help us understand the word that is more difficult, the second one, epiousion. Okay. So if we go to BDAG, which is the Bauer, Donker, Arndt, and Gingrich lexicon, standard lexicon for the Greek New Testament. The entry on epiousios, it says this in part. According to Origen, that's the patristic father, this was coined by the evangelists. Okay, like this is a term they made up, he says. Now, the entry is going to go a little bit away from that, or, kind of, sort of. It's going to be rare. It's going to be unusual. So part of the entry will say that maybe Origen was kind of onto something here. It's kind of unique. But then if you go, elsewhere through the entry, you're going to see, some other examples or similar terms. And so maybe they did coin the term. Maybe they sort of altered a known term, again, that has more of a chronological orientation to come up with this one. Again, this is the discussion that lexicographers are going to have. So you go through the entry, and they list a bunch of interpretations, and I'm going to give you three of them. There are other trajectories in the entry, but here's three. The question is, what is epiousios derived from? Again, if they coined this term, or if it, maybe they just, they took other terms that were common, put them together and sort of, made their own, or there's some nuancing here that can be otherwise understood. So here's one. I'm going to give you three. One option is that it derives from epi and ousia, which BDAG translates as that which is necessary for existence. And they cite Origen and Chrysostom and Jerome as, you know, this is the trajectory they take. This is where they think it comes from. So epi and ousia. Combining those two Greek terms to form epiousios, and the meaning would be that which is necessary for existence. And since we need to exist every day, which would be nice, we can't take a day off from existence, daily captures the idea. And of course, it's consistent with the other chronological language in the passage. However, there are a couple of other options. Some would say it is a substantivizing, it's a grammar term, of epi tein ouson, which would mean for the current day. And there's a little note in BDAG, when you get this phrase, epi tein ouson, according to what is necessary, you can imply that again, a daily sort of necessitary, a daily sort of necessity is implied here. And so they say you could, if that's where it comes from, it would mean something like for the current day or for today. And for each of these, they're going to cite, you know, different passages in Greek literature that get you to those terms, you know, epi tein ouson or epi ousia. You know, those are terms you're going to find in other Greek literature, and the context is consistent. They're saying, well, maybe the gospel writers, you know, used these passages or this kind of language to coin their own term. Third, they also say and cite examples that it could mean for the following day, again, using one of these breakdowns and then going that trajectory for the following day. And that goes well with the presence of semeron in Matthew, which means tomorrow. So again, we could go down other trajectories, but the term is it's rare. It's unusual. Its derivation is not a mystery, in that there are no possibilities as to, you know, having any hope of explaining this. That's not true. It's uncertain as to which one of the possibilities actually happened or actually is in the picture. That's the part that's uncertain. But as far as where this term might have come from, again, there are good options here. And a translation like daily, or, you know, for tomorrow or for the current day, something like that, that's well within the semantic range of these options and makes sense, given, you know, sort of the boots on the ground existence of the people that are listening to Jesus.
Our last question is from Curtis in College Station, Texas. Does the story of the prodigal son in Luke 15:11 through 32 elude to Deuteronomy 32:8 through 9? The father giving the inheritance to the rebellious son seems to match up fairly well.
Yeah, this one is actually going to be short. Might surprise the audience because the question includes Deuteronomy 32. I don't think so. In Deuteronomy 32:8 and 9, Yahweh doesn't give away his inheritance. He takes Israel as his inheritance. Now, I'm sure the thought process here, what's behind the question, is the idea of abandoning humanity more generally, you know, the surrender of the nations and so on and so forth. But the inheritance language that's actually in the verse pertains specifically to Israel, not to the nations that are being abandoned. So if we're thinking about inheritance being a potential link between Deuteronomy 32:8-9 and the prodigal son, you know, parable, if you're zeroing in on the inheritance, it doesn't fit, because Yahweh I'll use the language of Deuteronomy 4:19-20, the parallel to Deuteronomy 32:8-9. Yahweh takes his inheritance. He takes Israel as his own. He doesn't give it up. He takes it. So it's actually the reverse of the prodigal situation. But again, I think where the question really, you know, comes from is the notion of the you know, disinheritance is a term I like to use, or the abandonment of the nations. But again, the language of, you know, Deuteronomy 32 specifically relates to taking Israel as the inheritance. Now, sure, if God elects Israel, we'll use the E word there. If God elects Israel, then the others are non-elect. Okay, I mean, I can see that. But if you take that idea from Deuteronomy or the Old Testament generally, God making a positive choice suggests, you know, obviously, on the other hand, the negative choice. When you go to the prodigal son in Luke 15, again, it still doesn't line up, you know, very well. Because in that case, you'd have someone not being disinherited. He doesn't disinherit the prodigal. He gives him what he wants, but he's still his son. and the son comes back and, you know, everything is, you know, turns out, you know, well, and so on and so forth. And he comes to his senses and all that. So even under some of those assumptions, it doesn't, in my head, it doesn't really align well.
All right, Mike, just like that, we're done for this week. Don't forget, if you have your question, please send them to me at treystrickland@gmail.com. And just know that we can't get to everyone's, but the ones that we do get, we appreciate you sending those to us.
Thanks for that word of comfort.
And Mike, we appreciate you answering those questions. And next week we get back into Revelation, I believe Revelation 4. And and with that, Mike, I want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.